We'll move on to the last case of the day, which is State versus Abernethy. Morning. You may approach and you may proceed whenever you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm April O'Loughlin. I'm here on behalf of Helen Mr. Abernethy. Your Honor, in this particular case, my client's speedy trial rights were violated under 29-1207. For purposes of brevity, I'm not going to dispute the time my client on September 10th, 2019 was charged under an information. That time period between, that's when his speedy trial ran under 29-1207. For purposes of this argument, I'm not disputing that the fact between September 10th, 2019 and the motion to continue setting on the defendant's motion setting trial for January 22nd should count against my client under excludable time. However, I'm going to backtrack that a moment and say that the time period between on January 13th, the court on its own motion entered an order continuing the trial between January 13th and March 18th. That was not done at the request of either party. The court indicates in its order that it did it due to some problems with depositions and wanted to give the defense time to complete those depositions.
Did you object at that time at that hearing? It was at January 14th, 2020.
Was that issue was not addressed, as I recall, in the record. It came out in the court's order that it was continuing the trial and the reason that it was continuing the trial. So I would argue under 29-1207, there's no duty implied in 29-1207 for the defendant to object or to firmly object, especially when it's done on the court's own motion. There's no evidence submitted from the state under 29-1207 subsection 4 as to good cause, so I don't think good cause can be found, and that time has to count against the state for speedy trial purposes. So the time between January 13th and the court's issuance of a sua sponte order on March 17th, the speedy trial clock is running. That's important because in the court's January 4th order regarding the motion to discharge, they don't address that. It's just told against the defendant, and I would argue that's improper. On March 17th, the court in this particular case issues a sua sponte order. I know this court has heard a bevy of cases in State v. Chase and State v. Brown that address this issue. I was before this court a few weeks ago on that very issue. What I'm going to argue in this particular case is there's no Mortensen issue that the court has to stop its analysis at. And this court in this case is clearly distinguishable between Brown and Chase, and I'll explain why. In this particular case, the court issues an order on March 17th, in which it talks about its personal knowledge. The court in Brown addresses that a court can take judicial notice, but that there has to be known facts that are known to the court at the time. That's a fine line between State v. Baird and what this court has said in State v. Baird. In that particular case, the court was very clear that a court cannot testify, that the duty to establish good cause must be by the state. That's an absolute right-wing rule that, to my understanding, has not been overruled by State v. Chase or State v. Brown. In this particular case, the court issues an order on March 17th in which the court says the court has consulted with Sarpy and Cass Health Department and that the court has made findings as a result of that. During the March 17th hearing, then, the state specifically asked, and I think this is important, whether good cause had been found. The court specifically says, yes, I found good cause. I went in some length to talk about some of the circumstances surrounding the coronavirus to gather a large and the difficulties in gathering large numbers of people. So I continued it to the next pretrial panel and I found good cause under that. What's replevant in that is I. That is the court testifying. That's in clear violation of State v. Baird.
But it's not like State v. Baird, right? Because in State v. Baird, the judge was talking about the internal workings just of its court and who was available to work on what. Here, the judge is reciting knowledge that's general or known to everyone, what could be known at that time about the pandemic. Isn't that this different?
I think, Judge, that gets to the very heart of what this court said in State v. Brown, and I would argue that this case is different. In the court's order, the court specifically talks about information that it has gathered. during in issuing its order. I would argue that's distinguishable in this particular case. That assumes that the court has done its own investigation and has determined the outcome based in its order. That's consistent with Baird. That's testimonial. There's no evidence that's offered, and I know that this court has already said that a motion to discharge can backdate in terms of offering evidence.
You're talking about things that the trial judge said at the time of the continuance, correct?
I'm talking about both. If the court looks at both the issue.
Wasn't there evidence offered that after the motion for discharge was filed, didn't the state offer evidence outside of just the judge's personal knowledge?
Absolutely. And that's why I'm going to distinguish this case from State v. Chase and State v. Baird. In both of those cases, this court has said that it is proper for a state at the time of the motion to discharge to backdate evidence and offer what good cause would have been presented at the time that the court issued its orders. However, in this particular case, it's dispositive. On August 31st, the defense files a motion to discharge. That motion to discharge hearing is set for September 18th and then continued to September 29th. At the September 29th hearing, the state says in its order, specifically in its argument, because the court already found good cause, the state offers no evidence in support.
But that's not the end of the story, right?
Well, and that's why I would argue that for purposes of my argument, it is, Judge.
Well, right? But that's not the end of the story, though. So address, help us out. Why isn't what the state did after that good enough? The state files a motion and there's a subsequent hearing on the issue of whether there's good cause, and the state offers evidence in support of that.
Yes, Your Honor. At the time of the September 29th motion to discharge hearing is argued by both sides and deemed submitted by this court and under advisement, briefs are due and submitted. Once the defense then argues that State v. Baird applies in its argument during September 29th, the state then comes in after the fact and files a motion to establish good cause.
Was it the same date? Was it also on September 29th that they filed this motion?
After the conclusion of the hearing, the matter is deemed submitted. And that's clear in the court's issuance of the order that briefs are due. After that, then the state, and it's over objection by the defense, and the defense argues that the trial court does not have jurisdiction. The record is closed.
What's the distinction between what the court did and simply reopening the evidence on the hearing on the motion for discharge? That would be purely discretionary. And when you say lacks jurisdiction, there hadn't been a final order entered yet, had there?
Judge, I would agree with you on that. I would argue that it's a slippery slope. At what point does the state get to reopen the effort? Is it so the motion of discharge had been on file for a full month? It had been set for argument. If the state wanted to offer evidence, because the state conceded in its September 29th, well, Judge, you already made a finding, so we're not going to do anything. After the defense comes in and argues State v. Baird, the state goes back and reads State v. Baird. Oops. Now we're going to try to backdate this even more after the argument has been submitted.
Is there an assignment of error in this case of an abuse of discretion of allowing the additional evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, the defense argues that the state didn't, that the court did not have jurisdiction. And if I may address that argument.
Well, you're losing me on jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Jurisdiction is continuing until the court is deprived of jurisdiction by an appeal that's from a final order or a judgment, right?
I would agree with that, Judge.
How does the court lose jurisdiction? I'm having trouble following that.
Judge, my argument would be that the record is closed at the point that the matter is deemed submitted. And if it's a slippery slope.
Never to be reopened.
Well, that's, I guess, for powers.
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller. I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller Lerman, and my question would be to follow up on Justice Castle. We are working towards not using the word jurisdiction particularly loosely since the Ryan case. So perhaps your argument is the record was closed, and perhaps the judge erred by an abuse of discretion by reopening the record and receiving further evidence. And I do apologize to my colleagues if I spoke over you.
Thank you, Justice. That's exactly my argument. And in its order on January 4th order, in support of its order allowing the state to reopen the argument, the state, the court relies upon Malcolm v. Dell. That court, and in its order, the trial court says that a trial judge has broad discretion in the general conduct of a trial. That's what that case says. It addresses pretrial motions. It addresses motions for mistrial. Those are clearly within the discretion of the trial court. It does not in any manner allow this court to reopen a record to shore up the state's deficiencies. That's not the purpose of Malcolm v. Doyle, and that's the only authority that the trial court relies upon in its January 4th order. So I would argue that that's distinguishable, that the trial court abused its discretion, that the state should not have been permitted to reopen due to its deficiencies at a motion to discharge when it failed to realize that it needed to offer evidence. This court, that is clear in State v. Chase and State v. Brown. I would argue, Judge, that this case is distinguishable, that my client's speedy trial rights were violated, and that he's entitled to a motion to discharge.
Your time has expired unless there are further questions from the court. Seeing none, how much time did we allow appellant to go over?
I think, Karen, 42 seconds.
Very well. We'll add the 42 seconds to the state's time. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stacey Krause. I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska. I'm just going to skip straight to it, and it doesn't matter what the court did at the time of the continuance, because for whether or not this time is excludable under 4F, it matters what the whole of the record shows, and we have evidence at the state's motion to establish good cause, which is part of this whole of the record.
Should the motion to establish good cause have been filed either shortly after the motion for discharge or at least before the matter was deemed submitted?
Well, ideally, it wouldn't have been filed at all, and the evidence would have been just presented at the discharge hearing. But I think it was literally the same night as the discharge hearing.
Should we understand the motion to establish good cause as effectively a motion to reopen the record on the motion for discharge?
I think so.
And is that your understanding of what the district? How the district court treated it in its order denying discharge.
That is how the district court considered it, but I would argue that's not actually the argument that was made to the district court. It was not to reopen the evidence on the motion for discharge hearing. It was this whole jurisdictional argument that the record could not be reopened once the motion for discharge was filed.
The argument that the defendant made.
Yes, that was always the argument below is, we have a closed record as soon as that motion for discharge was filed. It was never until today that we have a closed record as soon as the matter was submitted.
Just to make sure I understand, the argument that the defense made was not that once the discharge hearing is held, that the state can't offer evidence. It's once the motion is filed,
yes,
the state can't.
Yes, you cannot backtrack and create it's good cause for this continuance that already happened.
The anti-chase.
Yes. Part. Yes. Exactly. And so I would also add that the defendant never objected to the actual substance of the state's evidence either. The objection was on the no jurisdiction and on the timeliness under Baird. And he also never objected to the court's March 17th continuance, even though the court stated in his continuance order that it was willing to address any speedy trial matters should the parties file a timely motion. Counsel said she would read the order and file any necessary motion. She didn't. That brings me to my next argument that the time periods for the court's March 17th and June 16th continuances should actually be excluded under 4B instead of 4F because the defendant consented to them. Last call, we talked about this and about how my position is that based on the wording of the speedy trial statute, 4F is actually a catch-all provision. I reiterate that point today based on the wording of other periods of delay not specifically enumerated in this section. And although this court has never found that it is, I think based on the plain and ordinary reading of the statute, that 4F is a clear catch-all provision. Justice Stacey, you asked me during that argument last call if I had a preference about what the statute should, the rule should be. Should trial courts take through 4A through 4E before actually analyzing 4F? And I said my position was based on the reading of the statute, but I had no preference. After reviewing this case, after thinking about it more, I actually do have a preference. And that is that courts shouldn't analyze 4F until they determine that the applicable periods of time don't fall under one of the other specifically enumerated subsections. And I say that not just because of the wording of the statute. I say that because I think it's linear. I think it's more efficient. And frankly, I just think it's easier that when you look at the record, you can look at it and analyze whether, okay, do I have a defendant's pretrial motion? Then I'm looking at 4A law. Do I have a continuance? Was it by the defendant or was it with his consent? Then I'm looking at 4B law. Okay, it was neither of those. Was it a continuance by the state? Then I'm looking at 4C law. Was it neither? Was it by the court? Then I'm looking at 4F law. Another reason, in cases like this, where the defendant actually consents to the court's continuances, then I don't think the trial courts, prosecutors, this court should frankly have to go through all of this that we've been having to do in these COVID cases, like spooking the prosecutor into having to file this motion to establish good cause, discussing whether or not the timing of the state's evidence was correct, or whether or not that evidence met good cause and how the specific findings required by good cause. When it really should be as simple as looking at the transcript of a hearing or a pleading for consent and excluding the time under 4B. I think the extra burden should not fall on the court of the state for an alleged error that frankly the defendant invited, or an alleged error, I should say.
During the time of June 16, 2020, the pretrial conference when the trial date was set, what exactly would be the consent shown by the defendant?
Yes, let me get to the exact call of base.
That's fine, Judge.
It was, yeah, so yes, thank you. The court said, set it for trial then September 8th. Defense counsel said, yes, sir. Court said, works for you. Defense counsel said, that's fine, Judge. The court then went on to ask whether or not it was okay with the prosecutor, Mr. Klein, and he said, yes, Judge. So to me, that's consent. Specifically asking if that date works.
And that was a period of time when the trial has been set that traditionally hasn't been viewed as a continuous in the past, has it?
It has been traditionally treated as, or
has it? It has not been traditionally treated as a continuous.
I don't know if we have any specific law. Your concurrence in State versus Coombs alluded to it. And I would agree with you. I mean, I don't see how you can fault the courts or the prosecutor when defense counsel can fault those parties when you're specifically asked, set it for trial. Is this matter still going to trial? It is. Set it for September 8th? Question mark. Yes, sir. Works for you? Yes. Like, if that doesn't work, or you have speed, you really want your speedy trial and you have speedy trial concerns, then say, no, it doesn't. But we need to move this up. I have a right to speedy trial.
Counsel, the argument, your 4B argument today, I don't remember. Was it in your brief?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And that's specifically because I argued in brief. I hope that this court addresses it and doesn't say there's no need to dispose of it, because Brown and Chase take care of the 4F good cause time. Because I do have a preference, and I really do think that it is linear, more efficient, and honestly easier when you're reviewing a record to just frankly look for who requested the continuance. If it wasn't the defendant, did he consent? Rather than go through everything that we've been going through with these COVID speedy trial cases.
So to follow up on that, the idea behind that is the colloquy should have been to avoid the 4B consequence, something to the effect of, well, Judge, I object to any postponement whatsoever, but if you're going to set a date, that date will work for me.
Get something on the record to say, I understand you're the court. You know, you have the authority here. I just want my objection part of the record for speedy trial purposes.
Wouldn't an easier way to go is to figure out what speedy trial is and make the request for the trial to occur before speedy trial expires, and we use this as a shield to move the trial forward as opposed to a sword or a gotcha after the fact?
Yeah, I think that would, yeah, that's part of, yeah, my reasoning of when you're saying that, like, when you're bringing up your objection, Judge, I have a right to speedy trial. I actually think it's going to run before then. I would like you to move it up.
I understand your preference for trial courts to go through a 4A or B analysis before getting to 4F. What's your preference, or what's the reason behind asking this court to address that in this appeal where we already have all of the 4F evidence developed and we already have decisions in Brown and Chase that presumably you think are controlling?
I mean, the reason, just to my personal reason, is just to create the case law to have the authority so that we don't have to go through this in the future, that we do have some type of procedure set forth for the courts to follow based on my plain and ordinary reading of the statute. I think that's what the statute actually requires. And trial courts haven't been advised of that yet. There are no further questions. Back to you from the judge in the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There is no rebuttal time, is that correct?
Very well, the cause is submitted and counsel are excused and we are adjourned for the day.
Thank you.